Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. We are awash in data, and it's easy to feel overwhelmed by it or even ignore it. But Andrea Poli's work strives to make that data visually compelling and even beautiful. Poli is a professor of art and ecology with appointments in the College of Fine Arts and School of Engineering at the University of New Mexico. She holds the Mesa del Sol Endowed Chair of Digital Media and directs the Social Media Work Group, a lab at the university's Center for Advanced Research Computing. Poli is this year's recipient of the Community Engaged Scholarship Lectureship Award, which recognizes exceptional scholarly work that embodies a UNM's commitment to community engagement. You can find a link to photos of her projects and to her lecture, STEAM in New Mexico, The Arts in Service, at KUNM.org. Andrea Poli, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You came here in 2009. Why is Albuquerque particularly a great place for the intersections that you're interested in?
Oh, my gosh. There's such a long history of that art-science interaction. You know, New Mexico is such a unique place. It's so beautiful. There's so much natural beauty. There's so many opportunities to get out into nature. But at the same time, there is the extremely high level of scientific research happening here. And of course, it's a huge center for art development and research. And in many different areas, you know, from painting to extreme high tech.
I know a lot of the work that you do actually involves visualizing data in very artistic ways. Why does that make more of an impact on people?
I don't know that it does, but I think it. I try to make it have an emotional connection to people somehow. So if it's a recognizable image or an image that can evoke certain feelings, maybe that's for people of the general public that aren't scientists or mathematicians, maybe that's more meaningful than a bar chart or a graph.
Can you talk about some of the projects that you've done, such as like the mist car or I called it the breathing car?
So since being in New Mexico, I started a lab, the Social Media Work Group, and involved students in these research projects. So there's always been students involved in all these projects. But I have done some really fun projects using vehicles, using cars. And one is called the cloud car. And it's a cloud covered in – or it's a car, sorry, covered in mist, inspired by Diller and Scafidio's Blur Building, with the idea that if you could see the emissions that your car is producing, this is what it might look like.
And you also did one with students called Particle Falls that you took to a lot of different places.
That one's been really around the world. Most excitingly to me, it was part of the COP21, the climate conference in Paris. And it is a huge computer-generated blue waterfall that transforms in the real-time presence of particulate pollution. So if there's a lot of particulate pollution, usually caused by fossil fuels, this blue waterfall will turn into a fireball.
You're actually seeing pollution in real time, distorting that.
Yeah, it was really challenging, too, to kind of figure out a way to show the pollution without this being something that people wanted to create, you know, like a beautiful image. And people still kind of do that. And, you know, when we're testing it, sometimes we'll get somebody who smokes. We'll take a long time to find somebody because nobody smokes anymore.
Well, you were in Paris, so that right. Probably wasn't hard. Oh,
that's true. That's true. Someplace in Europe, yeah. But we'll get somebody to blow smoke onto it and, you know, to test it and stuff.
And many of the projects that you do have sensors in them, how do you see that as key to grounding the projects in a community and what's going on in that community?
Well, they're really local. So everything we use with sensors has been extremely local, whether that's using GPS sensors or particulate pollution sensors. And when you are able to see what's happening in your immediate area, I think it becomes a lot more meaningful for people. And I know, for example, with some of the pollution projects, there have been parents who have come to our public meetings and have just expressed so much gratitude because they had been feeling that their child was getting sick all the time. And the idea that they could use something, you know, on the ground in their local area to tell them whether or not their child was being exposed to dangerous pollution was really useful and amazing to them. Because so a lot of times with particle falls, there's a community engagement aspect to it. So we do workshops and talks and public meetings and things related to pollution. And we're often supported by clean air groups. Another project that I did in New York that took three sites and took live Department of Transportation video of vehicles and live particulate pollution, I showed in a gallery in New York, and the guard at the gallery was a woman who lived in the Bronx, where some of the highest levels of asthma occur. And she came up to me and was really emotional, talking about her son who had asthma and that she believed, you know, came from the air pollution there.
Your projects have also deeply engaged your students. I mean, pretty much as equals in the creation. Why has that been so important?
Well, I think our students don't often get opportunities to collaborate across disciplines. So when I can put together a team of an engineering student and an art student and an architecture student or communication student, it's a new kind of opportunity for them usually. And I think they also often don't get these opportunities to take a project not only to completion, which they might do in the class, but into the real world and to have, I think there's a real difference when you put something out in the real world and you have people walking down the street seeing it and responding to it than the kind of response that you might have in a classroom.
Yeah. How have you and your students engaged the community in the creation of some of those projects? Could you talk about some of them? Like you had one on the Navajo Nation, I believe.
We worked with two Navajo artists, Vinaya Yazzi and Esther Berlin. And we interviewed people who had been had their lives affected by the two of the largest coal-fired power plants on Navajo Nation. They're located very near each other. They don't provide power to Navajo Nation, but they provide lots of power to here in Albuquerque and California and Phoenix and Vegas. So we took those audio interviews, which included an activist who physically put her body in front of bulldozers to keep a third power plant from being built. And we created an audio tour through Navajo Nation. Yeah, I guess in a certain way, when you say how did we engage the community, it's an interesting way of saying it, because in a certain sense, it's almost like we made ourselves a little bit invisible and just kind of tried to allow people to tell their stories.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with Andrea Poli. She's professor of art and ecology with appointments in the College of Fine Arts and the School of Engineering at UNM. She's this year's recipient of the Community Engaged Scholarship Lectureship Award. Her work often uses data visualization to highlight pollution and climate issues. You can see some examples at KUNM.org. Among the projects she did with her students was an installation using LED lights on the Rachel Carson Bridge in Pittsburgh that was designed to animate weather patterns.
We took wind speeds and wind directions and translated that into a visual animation that looked like a rainbow rain. So the speed and the density of the rain was affected by the wind. And the whole piece was powered by wind power. We worked with a wind power company called Windstax. And so in a way, we were showing the wind power potential on the bridge.
One that I really loved you did was you had weather stations. You actually had them sort of quote-unquote tweeting.
Yes.
You're tweeting like these great quotes from like authors and novelists about the weather.
We found 2,000 quotes that were under 140 characters, which was a tweet at the time. And I created this whole matrix of, you know, what kind of weather would tie in with what quote. And so if somebody subscribes to the weather station, they get the tweet. That was actually one of the first projects that was really collaborative and driven by my students, because we started to talk about, well, what kind of projects do you want to do? And they were really interested in tweeting and things with the cell phone and figuring out that kind of programming.
One of the other projects he did with your student was this kind of glow pod, and you also worked with Red Willow Farms on Taos Pueblo. So that integrated what, LEDs with traditional plants?
Yeah, we took traditional plants and we had sensors that measured the temperature and the moisture level of the plants. And then that data in real time was translated into lights on a spherical structure that we built with the help of some architecture students.
How do you think people sort of interacting this way with climatological data or environmental data, like how does that maybe transform their experience?
I think it makes it feel more real. For example, when we set up particle falls, we'll have the particulate sensor next to a street. And I was really blown away, actually, by how it responded to diesel vehicles. Like, diesel vehicles have this incredible amount of particulate pollution that they produce. And I physically saw it whenever, you know, here's a BMW. Oh, my God. You know? And I didn't realize there was such a difference.
You were also instrumental in bringing the IZEA Symposium to Albuquerque in 2012. Can you talk about what that was and why it was so important to have it here?
IZEA is the International Symposium for Electronic Art. It happens in a different place around the world every year. At the time when we proposed it for 2012, it hadn't been in the U.S. for about 6 years. It had been in many other cities around. And it had never really been in a city that is like Albuquerque and so spread out and kind of a lower population kind of a city, but such an important place for art science and electronic art.
Yeah, talk about that, because one thing that came out of it, I think, was you created STEAM New Mexico and you use the Vista AmeriCorps program. So what is that? What does it do?
So STEAM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math with the arts. And about maybe 20 years ago now, I was part of a group that went to the National Science Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts a meeting in D.C. that kind of talked about what collaborations might happen. And we brainstormed STEAM. STEM was really used and is still used today, science, technology, engineering, and math. And so my group and many other groups that were in D.C. at that time brainstormed this idea of STEAM. STEAM really took off at places like Rhode Island School of Design and other schools. And so with the help of AmeriCorps Vista, I started STEAM New Mexico in 2014, and we started partnering across the state, mostly in that central northern corridor, to help promote STEAM education throughout various New Mexico communities.
So you're using AmeriCorps, people who are in AmeriCorps, they can sort of extend that reach.
They work full-time with our partners. We have had as many as 15 AmeriCorps Vistas. We have about 10 now. And they are working with CNM. They're working with Taos Paseo. They're working in several different departments throughout UNM. We have worked with AFRL. We've worked with...
That's the Air Force Advanced Research Laboratory?
Air Force mm-hmm. Research Laboratory. We've worked with a number of different partners over the years, so they'll be placed, you know, full time, helping to do outreach, helping to provide community support.
Why is it so important to have STEAM versus STEM? We hear a lot about STEM. Mm-hmm. We don't hear as much about STEAM, but integrating the arts with technology and math and engineering.
Well, I think it really helps increase diversity in those fields, especially here in New Mexico. I think we have such a long tradition of, for example, Native American arts that have a very strong grounding in STEM, in engineering and math and science, but they express – those ideas are expressed through the arts. So the arts often come very naturally to people. And I think in a lot of ways STEAM helps to get the word out about – some of these important topics and these important advances and issues and questions that are being posed by science.
You have a concept that you talk about through your work. It's about hacking and creativity. Can you talk a bit about that?
So hacking, I use the kind of original definition of hacking, which is to make something your own. And I think it's a really about working hands-on and trying to understand something hands-on. So, you know, if your toaster breaks, to open it up and see what's going on and try and fix it, or opening up the hood of your vehicle. And I think it's becoming maybe less and less something that people do, maybe in a certain sense by design, because designers are often making things not hackable or trying to make things more difficult to hack.
Why is that so important?
Well, I think there's so much misinformation and information that we need to process now, you know, very much maybe like what we were talking about with the sensors, where you can actually see what's going on in your environment in a really direct way. I think being able to understand, you know, these devices and machines that we're surrounded by on a more deep level helps us to sift out that information.
Your lab here, the Center for Advanced Computing, can you talk about what that is, what you do? You know,
so the students? Center for Advanced Research Computing is a university-wide lab where researchers can go and work on interdisciplinary projects. So my lab, the Social Media Work Group and STEAM&M, is one of many labs that are housed at the Center for Advanced Research Computing that also houses supercomputers for research. And that's just right over on University and Central. And if you cruise by there at nighttime, you'll see lights installations that we've created all over the building.
Yeah, I like that you, because most of your installations, they're ephemeral, they're not permanent, and you've often recycled stuff you've used, which seems to be part of your ethos as well, right?
For sure, yes, and also economical.
There's always that.
Right.
You also started working in bio art. How are you integrating that into your work here? Maybe talk about what that is.
Yeah, that's been really fascinating. We've been offering a bioart and design course at UNM for about 6 years. Bioart has really only been around for about 20 years, but it's really taken off lately. It's with the advent of synthetic biology. So the ability to manipulate genetics, CRISPR, for example, these tools that really, in a sense, some people have said move biology into more of a computational kind of medium. So these tools are becoming more and more accessible. Just like in the hacking, where microcomputers have become more and more accessible and more affordable. Yeah, my students in bioart and design have been coming up with some fascinating ways to hack their bodies and the environment to...
Hacking their bodies? Right. What does that mean?
Oh, there's a great project that a couple of my students worked on last semester, where they discovered that tears have a certain hormone in them that reduces testosterone and aggression. So they decided to develop a project. It's a speculative project, but a project that uses tears to fight against microaggressions.
Wow.
Yeah, really.
That's really interesting.
Definitely out of the box thinking.
One of your newest projects, and I know we'll hear more about this tomorrow morning on Weekend Edition with Spencer Beckwith, but I just wanted to ask you about it briefly. The installation at the Box Theater on Gold Street?
It's still up now. I don't know how much longer it'll be up. It'll be probably up at least through the holiday. It's called The Game of Life, and it's a grid of circles, pixels. Each pixel represents a kind of a life form, and it lives or dies, it turns off or turns on, based on the number of living beings around it. When I say living beings, I guess I mean lights around it, okay. So the pixels. So you do have to be there, because it's always changing, and the patterns that you see when you go by there may never happen again in the lifetime of that piece. Yeah. It's pretty wild.
And you're working on a new public piece for the California Air Resources Board?
The California Air Resources Board is building a new facility. They are the organization that's kind of the watchdog for air quality throughout California. they're supporting 6 major public artworks at this new facility, and I'm doing one on the front green, and so right in front of the building, that's going to be a shape inspired by the microscopic structure of pollution. And that shape is going to be covered in lights. You'll be able to enter the shape and be immersed by those lights that are going to be responding to air pollution. In a certain way, it's very much inspired by what's been happening out there with the fires. So there's a way in which as you enter the piece, you're going to kind of be engulfed in the air that hopefully is not bad because of fires, but, who knows?
As climate change continues to accelerate, what role do you hope you can play along with your students with projects like this?
You know, I've been really inspired by what's been happening with the student movement against climate change and against extinction. So I guess I just hope to be a supportive voice and, maybe a cheerleader for the incredible things that young people are doing now.
That was Andrea Poli. She's a professor of art and ecology with appointments in the College of Fine Arts and the School of Engineering at UNM. She's this year's recipient of the Community Engaged Scholarship Lectureship Award. You can see photos of her projects at kunm.org. And now we go to our segment highlighting research you may never have heard about.
Nobody's ever gonna read that!
This is Marty Adam-Smith, afternoon freeform host, in the studio with David Putoff of the University of New Mexico Department of English. How are you doing today, David?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming in. Brought you in to talk about your PhD dissertation, which is on interracial and interclass solidarity in the United States during the 19th century. So starting before the Civil War and continuing up through after it. And is there any particular significance to the present year, to 2019, with reference to the history of slavery?
Yeah, so 2019 actually marks the 400 years since the first enslaved folks were brought over to the Americas from West Africa.
What else can you tell me about your dissertation overall?
So overall, I'm looking at a variety of texts. Early on, I'm looking mainly at activist societies, and then I continue to look at the novel as it develops through the century. My focus in Chapter 1 is on David Walker, who was a free black activist and abolitionist who was born free in the South and moved to Boston later in life.
What did his activism primarily consist in?
In Boston, he was very active in abolitionist societies, but he also witnessed the Denmark Vesey revolt in South Carolina. We think he probably did. He was living there at the time. So he saw both modes of activism.
Yeah, the more radical version, like the connected to the John Brown narrative that everybody's familiar with.
Correct.
And also, what would an activist society look like in the 1820s?
Those societies came together. They formed sort of congresses. There were calls in abolitionist papers for folks to get involved. Delegates would come from different cities, New York, Philadelphia, Boston were the big ones. They would read the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, for example, talk about how their values were in line with that and how they were denied the vote and denied citizenship in a supposedly free society. And then they would organize. They would decide how they would go about agitating for inclusion. They also looked at efforts like the American Colonization Society, which tried to send free black folks to Africa, despite the fact that they've been living in the United States for generations.
Mm-hmm.
So they were just kind of evaluating their allies and where they stood and then going from there.
How do we know David Walker historically, primarily in the present day?
We mainly know him through a tract called Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World. It's got a much longer title than that, but I'll use that for the shorthand.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what he wrote. This is what he left behind, his legacy.
And what sort of document was it?
Its main audience were enslaved black folks in the South. So folks who were being held in bondage. Largely, these folks were illiterate, although there had been some growing movements to get literacy, usually grassroots movements. And so this document itself is actually largely secular. It does draw on biblical morals and ideas, some history, but it also draws on Greek and Roman history. And it makes an argument that the creation of America is bound up in the blood, sweat, and tears of enslaved folks and African Americans. So it's not, we can't say it's strictly a religious document, but it does seem more secular than some other arguments at the time. But considering that most people had morals grounded in the Bible, it was radical for its moment.
What was the diffusion, what was the spread of this document like? You mentioned the VC revolt, and Denmark VC was somebody who had some kind of general store, and that played a role in his ability to organize in South Carolina?
Yes. So actually, Vesey's organizing in South Carolina was amazing. He only seemed to have organized for a few years, was able to get maybe 1,000 people involved in a rebellion. The rebellion was found out and stopped, but there was a store at the center of the conspiracy, and it seemed that a lot of people, both free and enslaved, kind of passed through the store to get the daily news and to talk about their condition. So I think this was a really important inspiration for Walker, because we know that he was in South Carolina, and then after the Vesey revolt, he moved to Boston, where he actually opened up a clothing store. So it seems like the idea that the clothing store, that a store in, of any kind, could be a nexus of socializing, of organizing, I think that might have been some inspiration for him. And he also used the clothing store to distribute his tract, to distribute the pamphlet. He'd give them to sailors, but he'd also sew them inside the clothing. So it would be sort of smuggled document that way.
Oh, it was hidden?
Yeah.
It was hidden inside the goods?
Yeah. So it'd be just like in the lining of a jacket, right? Like he would take the thread out, put the pamphlet inside, and sew it back in.
Wow, that's fascinating. And so who were the customers? It was a store for black people, right?
Yes. So largely his store was in a free black district. It was also near the docks. So we theorize that it was his main audience were sailors, or that his primary audience, like the main distributors of his pamphlet, would be sailors. And this is borne out by the fact that the pamphlet was found as far away as New Orleans.
Do you see any present day equivalents to something like sewing pamphlets, radical pamphlets, inside of clothing?
One thing that comes to mind is I used to work at a bookstore, and families would come in and ask for us to send books to family members in prison.
Oh.
So that definitely comes to mind. There were limits on what could or couldn't be sent, and what we could and couldn't send ourselves or order for them. And so those books would be like highly vetted, right? Like we'd ship them, and if there was anything wrong with the process, they would be immediately returned. People would want to send sometimes, you know, something like the autobiography of Malcolm X, right?
Right.
For example, and that was like a no-go.
Really?
Yeah.
So, yeah, when we think of systems like slavery versus systems like the present day prison system, what do you see as the essential difference between them?
Well, that's a good question. I think what they have in common is that they're both totalitarian systems, right? They both really seek to lock down the human body and the human soul and make sure that there's no thinking outside the box, make sure that everybody's will is bent towards a particular way. What makes them different, I think, well, slavery's totalitarianism was based on different technologies than modern-day prisons, obviously. There was an attempt at total control, but the technologies weren't as precise. So while you had the lash or the coffle, like the way that you chain people together at the neck, and these were highly effective technologies of control, people still found a way to exploit loopholes, right? And it's different with prisons today, whereas with David Walker, for instance, you could smuggle a book via ship and onto a plantation without too much trouble. The loopholes were pretty big, but the loopholes today are much smaller. It's hard to smuggle a book into a prison to get anything like that's not light, fluffy reading, you know, to someone who really needs other words.
Any other last thoughts for our listeners?
I guess just the significance of David Walker today. It's really worth revisiting his pamphlet, revisiting his words and his work. It's really inspirational to see, like, here's a man who's got a lot of criticism for the United States, right? But it's born out of a love for the message of the potential message of equality, and his fiery rhetoric, his passion, it really is, like, springs up from every page. We need folks there who will hold that promise.
Great. And that was David Walker's appeal.
It is appeal to the colored citizens of the world.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming in, David.
Thanks for having me.
That was Marty Adams-Smith with David Puthoff, PhD candidate in American Literature at the University of New Mexico. You can find this episode and all our previous episodes at KUNM.org. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.